the guys from Ping, they've kind of shown me how much the equipment matters.
I just love that I can hit any shot I kind of want.
We're going to be able to tell some fun stories about what goes on here to help golfers play better golf.
Welcome back to the Ping Proving Grounds podcast. I'm Shane Bacon. That is Marty Jurtson. Marty, we're going to tackle a topic that I'm assuming people that listen to this podcast are going to be excited about today. I mean, who better to chat about high handicap golf than us with Andrew Rice?
Absolutely. Andrew's been a ambassador for us for a number of years now. And I think, Shane, what comes back to me when I think of Andrew is when we were in the archives with Rob Griffin, our historian, and he said that Carsten Solheim's mission was to help the average golfer. Well, I think that really, you know, I think embodies Andrew and what he's trying to do on the teaching and coaching side. I couldn't be more excited to talk to him about it.
Guys, thanks so much.
Andrew, when you dive into the world of high handicap golf, I mean, as somebody that is awful at instruction and really doesn't have any idea of how to help any golfer in the world, I try to help my buddies and it doesn't go so well. Where do you start? Like, what's the first step to someone that is struggling to break 100 or struggling to break 90?
I think for me, you know, I regard the foundation of golf as the hitting of the golf ball. I often say to people, it's not that the short game and putting doesn't matter, but if we're getting the ball up and down and we're holding these 20-foot putts for doubles and triples, it doesn't make a whole big of a difference. And so it's really ultimately about the hitting of the golf ball. I like to look at the ball flight. What's the golf ball doing? How far is it going? How high is it flying? How much is it curving? And then back things up from there and say, okay, let's talk. I like to interview my students, talk to them and say, tell me what's ailing, what's happening, what's going wrong, and how can I help you to start to have more joy out on the golf course? That's really what it's got to be all about.
I think, Andrew, it's going to be one of my first questions to you is what brings you, what kind of motivates you to teach golfers every day? What brings you the most joy or excitement when you wake up? I mean, I've never seen you lack excitement and enthusiasm when you're interacting with other teachers and then your students. What is that motivating factor for you?
Marty, people are coming to me because there's invariably something wrong and they're looking to leisure time. We all greatly value our leisure time. And for most of us, golf is a big part of that leisure time. And we want to be able to go out there and take advantage of that opportunity we've got to be out enjoying the game. And the better we play, the more fun we have. And so I really want to help people, just like I said earlier, enjoy themselves, have more joy when they're out on the golf course. And you guys both know it. If you're playing well, it's a lot more fun out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just when I, you know, I think about when I'm struggling with my golf game, like I'm currently in a bit of a funk with my golf game right now, and you feel very lost, like nothing really makes a lot of sense. And of course, the scary part is then your brain gets in the way, right? Now you're thinking, is it golf swing? Is it my alignment? You know, I mean, am I hitting the right club? You start to question everything. When you have people approach you for a first time, I'm assuming that all of those characteristics are coming with them. It's like a lot of baggage, right? I mean, they've got two or three bags they're checking on the flight. How do you, A, focus on bag number one, which either is golf swing, brain, whatever the case may be, and then what is a win from a first lesson or a first experience with somebody that comes your way? Is it just clearing the clouds? Like, what is a victory for you off the bat?
One of the questions I ask all of my students when I meet them for the first time, Shane, is, what would you be happy with walking off this lesson tee today? And so they're going to tell me straight away, okay, that gives me insight as to what's ailing, what they're looking to achieve. And I've learned over the years, give them that. Do everything I can do to give them that. And so what would they like to achieve? And then spend our time together working towards that. If we've got extra time and we can get that done very quickly, then we're going to look at some other things that might add to this cherry on the top, so to speak. But I really want to help them achieve their objective. It's oftentimes ball flight. They want to hit it longer. They want to hit it higher. They want to hit it straighter. They want to strike it better. And I'm going to get them there and then do what I can to provide them with the tools necessary so they can start to revisit that space more often.
Andrew, how has golf instruction changed since you first got into it? I think you kind of, I admired before we got to know each other, seeing how you were an early adopter of TrackMan, using it to do research projects. Quite frankly, when it first came out, it was a fancy tool, and the golf instruction, they kind of out crowdsourced the research projects to golf instructors. You latched onto that early and did some research with it. How has tools and technology, TrackMan, for example, maybe some more contemporary tools, changed your approach to teaching? What has that kind of journey or evolution been like for you?
Marty, a lot of teachers will say, well, so-and-so, Butch Harmon was my mentor, David Ledbetter was my mentor, and I certainly started teaching working for David Ledbetter. I would have to say that golf technology, most importantly, TrackMan, was my mentor in that it taught me what causes the ball to fly a certain way and what numbers to look for. And I know this might sound a little technical, but it really isn't. I look at TrackMan as a great feel machine, a great piece of feel generating technology. And so I used TrackMan early on to gain some insight as to what causes the ball to make that great sound, fly that beautiful little tight draw. What are the numbers that are affiliated with that? And if I've got a student and they're a long ways away from that, we're almost always trying to neutralize what they're doing and work them back to a straighter ball flight, a more appropriate trajectory. And we don't want anything too extreme. And so TrackMan, that teaching technology, has been really integral for me as a teacher to teach me what really matters. It's not so much the look of the golf swing. It's far more about the function of the golf swing. And I think of Jim Furyk and Eamon Darcy and some of those classic, unique golf swings, Kelvin Peet, and those players could really make the ball sound great, fly straight down towards their target. And that's ultimately what we're looking for. It shouldn't necessarily be about trying to get every golfer to look like Adam Scott. I want everyone's different. Everybody's unique. You guys are both fantastic players. I was thinking, if there ever is a podcast open where they invite two players from each podcast, I know where I'm going to put my money. You guys would be a pretty strong squad there. But just to give people some insights as to how can you take your golf swing and start to use what you do to hit better shots. It doesn't have to be this revamp. You don't have to build this beautiful Adam Scott looking golf swing. It can be with what you have, just perhaps a little change at address, some ball position, maybe even some equipment upgrades to get that ball starting to obey what you're trying to get it to do.
Yeah, Andrew, it's a great point, because the idea of an overhaul to the golf swing for an adult golfer, you know, somebody that's got a job and they've got a weekly game they play and they've got kids, they've got a family. The idea of a complete overhaul, which maybe some golfers need, is very intimidating and, quite frankly, something most people are not going to be that interested in. So you have to almost push that to the side and focus on very, very small tweaks to help a golfer out. And that is not a very easy thing to do. One thing I do find so interesting, and Marty already mentioned it, is attitude is such an important part of instruction. I mean, if you show up to the first tee and you're in a bad mood, or you're not having a great day, or you don't seem like you want to be there, then the player is not going to get adequate advice, or at least what they feel like they're paying to get. And you seem like someone that brings the positivity, you know, brings kind of an upbeat personality to that first tee, and at the same time understands that not everybody showing up is down to change their entire golf swing like Tiger did five times.
Correct, correct. What, you know, Tiger is, we all know this, amazing. And he is...
And the outlier.
He's the outlier. Exactly right. Exactly right. And so people would love to have the ability to do what Tiger has done on multiple occasions. But that thing called life gets in the way, and it's family and it's work. And it's, I've only got so much time that I can dedicate towards golf. Give me what you can so that I can fit that into my little window, my little golf window. I can go out and practice, maybe even hit 15 balls before I go out to play. What can I feel and think and maybe do something at home in front of the mirror to start to help me hit some better shots? And it's taken a long time, but I think I finally realized why. You look at all those Golf Digest and Golf.com top teacher lists, and there's not a lot of 25-year-old teachers on the list. And I realize why, because it just takes a long time to be able to interpret and understand people, not so much golf swings, but just people. And I'm going to talk and I'm going to ask my students questions. And hopefully that's going to give me some insight as to who they are and what's going to help them and how I can best help them.
Marty, I was thinking about this in terms of ping and a lot of the technology that we've talked about on this podcast, because something you've done such a great job with, you know, so many of the tools and AI and things like that, is to try to get people to feel comfortable making a change without having to go to the golf course and change it on the range or on the golf course or spend those months, maybe even introducing new equipment, you know, the popularity of the 7-wood or the crossovers booming popularity over the last few years. The technology that you've worked so hard on has made this easier for golfers to feel more comfortable just putting a new golf club in their bag.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a magical thing, Shane, when you can go out and let's say a golfer's never hit a 7-wood, they hear about it on the podcast, they see tour players using it, they go get one, they can make their same swing with those characteristics and traits to it and start hitting good shots immediately. I think that's our own way of kind of bringing some immediate joy into this game. Andrew, on the topic of equipment, what are some, because you see a lot of folks come through through your clinics and your schools that you do, and you have seen, one of your biggest roles with us as a brand ambassador is to represent the people. And what are you seeing out there in terms of what does their bag look like? What are some equipment mistakes they are making? And then, you know, we can design into those gaps or better message those gaps, fit those gaps. What are some big mistakes you see, common mistakes you see in the high handicapper, everyday golfers' golf bags right now?
Marty, I must say, over the last few years, I think you guys have done an excellent job in getting longer irons out of golfers' bags. That's a great thing. They've been replaced with some nice hybrids that can help the ball get up in the air. But I must say, I still see 3-woods. I still see, in my opinion, too many 3-woods. And the average golfer, certainly male golfer out there, female lady golfers most often do not need a 3-wood. But the average male almost feels like they need to be a man and they need to, I need a 3-wood. You know, give me a driver and a 3-wood. I'll have some other things beyond that. But far too many golfers still have 3-woods in their bag. And that's a low line drive type ball flight. And I just see golfers getting so much more out of, you mentioned the 7, out of the 5 perhaps, something they can get up in the air. And I still see far too many golfers with that traditional 15-degree 3-wood that they're trying to hit off the deck and really not having much joy with.
Shane, we have some very interesting data on that. So Andrew brings up the 3-wood. We mined our Arcos data and found that golfers who hit the ball, who hit their driver 250 yards, hit the 3-wood off the tee 50% of the time and off the ground 50% of the time. But Andrew, if you hit your driver 200 yards, you're hitting your 3-wood or your lowest lofted fairway wood 80% of the time off the ground, 20% off the tee. But if you drive it 300, you hit it 80% of the time off the tee and 20% of the time off the ground. So I think, you know, we use that in fitting because if you're a fast club head speed player, you want to focus on your 3-wood more as a tee shot club. You're saying you're seeing the everyday golfer hit, you know, needing to play a 3-wood. And we know the data shows they need that thing getting off the ground very easily 80% of the time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I would, if you can perhaps work some magic, Marty, and please build this amazing fairway wood club. You can even put a big giant 3 on the bottom so everyone feels good, but just give it like a 5 or a 7 wood loft to shoot that thing up in the air. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, just the approach shots. I mean, you know, you're hitting shots into par 4s. And I mean, you're hitting these, you know, in theory, hitting a fairway wood on a lot of par 3s. I mean, why not make that easier on yourself versus having to absolutely make the perfect swing with the 3-wood?
For sure.
Yeah, and I think our SFT, Andrew, is a great option there. You know, by a standard loft, 16 degrees, you can obviously tweak it up with the sleeve, turns over a little bit easier. But yeah, we've been doing some things to make our fairways get up in the air a lot easier, moving the center of gravity lower, etc. But I'm so glad you highlighted that, that 3-wood is an area, as we've seen recently, last 5 years probably is a trend, more folks being comfortable getting those long irons out of their bag.
Yeah. And I really do think golfers are starting to be okay with, particularly the men golfers that I teach, they're starting to be okay with something with more loft as their primary fairway wood.
Yeah.
But there's still so many people out there who believe they've got to get a driver and a three wood. And that really isn't the case.
Andrew, you mentioned equipment and a big mistake that high handicappers make in terms of their equipment. What would you say is the number one thing you feel like high handicappers struggle with that is almost consistent throughout people that come to see you? Is it alignment? Is it not understanding their own distances? What do you feel like is the number one thing you almost see every single time you have a higher handicap come your way?
The universal thing, I'm glad you asked this question, Shane. I think it's a goodie. The universal thing is, how far do I hit the golf ball? Mm. And I love, you know, I'll have someone on TrackMan and they've hit 5 or 6 7 irons. And I'll go, so how far do you normally hit a 7 iron? And I'm looking at the real data and they go, 165. And I know that I swing, you know, 10 to 15 miles an hour faster than them. And my carry with a 7 iron is like 164, and yet they hit it 165, and I'm going, oh, that's weird, because I've just seen you carry, your best one carried 138. And I think it's twofold. Number one is golfers seem to have latched onto how far they hit a 7 iron in a total capacity, what the land plus roll is. And total is dependent on course conditions. The golfer is responsible for the carry. The golf course is responsible for the total. And I'd love for golfers to start to get a better idea as to what the actual carry number is. It might be a hard pill to swallow. I know that. But you will play better golf. And ultimately, you're listening to this because you might want to pick up a nugget or two to help you play better golf. Find out what your carry numbers are first. And then second, let's get rid of the ego. We know that back in 1991, you used to hit a 7 iron a lot further, but today is today, and we're happy to be playing golf. If you can have a carry number that is accurate, you cannot help but play better golf. And we all know this. If golfers can start to hit more greens, they simply have to score lower. They have to have more fun out there.
Oh, Andrew, I absolutely love that. And that's what I think we hear, and when I've played in tour events, it's all about that carry number. Like, where do you want that ball to pitch? That's absolutely what you can control. I love that. I think a couple tools out there for the listener that they can use. One, you can measure your actual tendencies on course with a tool like Arcos, number one. And that's been really fun to showcase, Andrew. Mm. We've seen all the data. I'm sure you've seen it from your individual students or on the big data of what percentage of the time golfers come up short on the golf course, right? And it with their irons, it is a...
Marty, do you have a number on it? Do you have an idea of what the number is?
Well, it's just kind of a heat map. And I guess for the listener out there, maybe picture the shape of like a pear, you know, where the pin is at the top and the rest of the heat map is down there underneath. That's kind of what it looks like for everybody. You know, so that's a fun one. And then number two, Shane, with our gapping app and Copilot, our folks who come in and get fit, this is kind of an unintended consequence of that tool, is we give you a projected carry distance of all your clubs. And we have our folks can come get fit and use that Copilot, and they get their carry distances. Yeah, and then you can go play golf and double check them. But Andrew, that's a way we can really help that golfer without them having to go, because it takes a long time to go do a full gapping and hit all your clubs and enough good shots. We can kind of calculate that and estimate that for them. Has been super duper helpful.
That is massive. And to me, Marty, that's like the low hanging fruit. You know, that makes my job as an instructor easier. I'm helping my students save strokes without really changing their golf swing at all. It's just, let's get a better understanding. Let's get some good, accurate information. And you can straight away go out for the next round you play. You can start to hit more greens, save some strokes.
Yeah.
Andrew, this is one of my biggest complaints about golfers in general, is you spend so much of your life focused on the game of golf, whether it be, you know, wanting to travel with your buddies and play golf trips, or you're grinding to get that handicap down. Yet you don't really understand anything about your own golf game. And this goes through a couple things we've talked about. A, equipment, understanding what best is for you. And it's maddening running into people that aren't getting fit routinely for golf equipment. Because again, you're investing so much of your life. I mean, imagine a country club membership. You know, I mean, what are you, you're these days you're laying down at minimum $20,000, at maximum, I don't even know how much, $1 million for a country club membership yet.
Yeah.
Yet you're not, you don't totally understand what your bag is about. And then to your point about the actual carry numbers is not having a total grasp of how far you hit every single club is just doing yourself a disservice, right? It's like driving a car and the speedometer being off, right? And you're like, I think I'm going 55, officer. I don't know. You know, like it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It really does. And it's easy stuff. It's the problem is it's not sexy. It's not appealing. It's not like, oh, I saw, you know, John Rahm's downswing and I want to get mine to look like that. Well, John Rahm's done a lot of stuff to know how far his clubs go, to get himself fitted, to get himself in the right equipment. And then he gets up and hits the ball. Let's start there. And we can really have a good head start on playing better golf.
Andrew, let's go back to TrackMan a little bit. And the listener of the Ping Proving Grounds podcast, there's some techies out there, so it's okay to talk a little techie here. What are some of the key club delivery and or ball metrics you really hone into? You could pick maybe a 7-iron, Andrew, or a driver. You know, are you looking at path, face, you know, horizontal swing plane? And how do you kind of manipulate those things? What numbers are you kind of using as your guideline for those metrics you're looking at?
Marty, firstly, I don't really, I'm not overly concerned with the shape of somebody's shot as long as it's appropriate, as long as it's not too much, it's not extreme.
Yep.
If fades work just as well as draws, and I'm sorry to let everybody know that, but that's a fact. You don't necessarily have to hit a draw in order to play good golf. Fades can work just as well. I'm looking for something club path-wise, 3 degrees out to in, 3 degrees in to out. When we're hitting shots off the ground, I'm looking for a mild downward strike anywhere between 1.5 and 5.0-ish. If we're talking irons being struck off the ground, an interesting thing is the dynamic loft. What is dynamic loft? It's the loft of the face. At impact, what does the golf ball experience? The dynamic loft. And a lot of golf coaches and golfers don't really get and understand the role that those two need to play, the two being club speed and dynamic loft. And I do believe we've got to match those up. The higher the speed, the lower the dynamic loft needs to be. I know that, Marty, if you hit a 7-iron that launches at 20 degrees and I hit a 7-iron that launches at 20 degrees, your ball is going to go significantly higher than mine because your club speed, ball speed is higher. And ultimately, if you launch a 7 at 20 degrees, that's not a good thing for you because your ball is going to go too high and it's going to be out of control. You know that better than everybody, really. But for the golfer with that slower club speed, they need to launch the ball at 20. And so that's something that I'm going to look for. Club path, attack angle, club speed, but I really want to tie that club speed to an appropriate dynamic loft because that's going to be that trajectory factor. So many golfers that I teach will typically hit the ball too low. And if I run into somebody who's hitting it too high, it's just weak and ineffective. Well, then we're going to try to bring the loft down. But we are going to, I'm certainly going to try to marry their club speed with that club to an appropriate dynamic loft because that gets the ball to a playable height where it's not overly high and gets out of control. And it gets up enough to where it can land and stop on a green.
Andrew, I wanted to ask you about practice, especially for high handicap golfers. I mean, so much of the time we hear just focus on 100 yards and in, focus on pitching and chipping and putting. What do you tell people that come your way about practice? If they have an hour to practice, how do you break that down for high handicap players?
Shane, firstly, I'm overjoyed if they have an hour that they can practice. That's a good start. Okay. If you want to get better, you simply have to practice. You cannot listen to a podcast or watch an instructional video.
Don't tell them that, Andrew.
Yes, they can.
They might unsubscribe.
This is where they're getting the gold, though. They've got to get out there and go and practice, firstly. I would say this. I think driver practice is underrepresented.
Love that.
I'd like to see golfers hit a lot more drivers. I'd like to see golfers actually practice generating more speed. How do you do that? I think at the end of your practice session, reserve anywhere from a dozen to 20 golf balls, and you're loose, you're ready to go. And ideally, if you've got some kind of feedback device helping you with club speed or ball speed, you're going to get up there and try to rip those golf balls as hard as you can just to see what you can do. There's also another great teaching aid that Marty might know about called the Stack. That's fantastic. This is not meant to be a plug for the Stack, by the way. I think it's a fantastic tool, and it's invaluable in helping golfers hit their golf ball closer to the green. If you think about what golf is, it's what are we trying to do on irons? We're trying to get the right distance so we can have our ball finish closer to the hole. When we're chipping, pitching, closer to the hole. When we're putting, in the hole. The same goes for tee shots. Let's practice our driver so that A, we can make it go a long way, and B, we can work towards keeping it in play. I'd love to see golfers spend more time practicing with their driver. And then I don't think that block practice has received much of a good rap over the last few years. And it is my opinion that every golfer needs to do some degree, some amount of block practice, and then work from block. And what is block practice? It's a seven iron. You're working on your swing, and you're just hitting a bunch of seven irons all to the same target. You're trying to get a feel for that motion, that strike, that new change that you might be working on. Spend some time doing that. But then I would love for you to go, okay, I need to take this and change this, work this over into the golf course. Because so often golfers will say, Andrew, I'm good on the range. I'm horrible on the course. I know if you're listening, there's a lot of people nodding their heads right now.
Marty and I are nodding our heads.
How can we possibly make it better? We can never recreate the golf course on the range, but we can get closer. And instead of just hitting 57 irons and going, whew, I think I got this. Today's going to be a great day. And you step on the first tee and that thing's in the water off the first tee. That's because the manner in which you practiced had very little to do with what is required on the golf course. And so spend a portion of your practice time hitting golf course style shots. Pick out a target, rotate clubs frequently, try to hit to the sides of targets, use your pre-shot routine. And then I think now you're practicing, now you're preparing to go out and play ultimately better golf. Some block practice, some random practice where you're trying to mirror, imitate what you're doing out on the golf course and throw in a couple of speed shots at the end. I think you're in good shape.
I love that, Andrew. I think that was one of my biggest regrets in hindsight, looking back on my own golf career, is over practicing the 50-yard shot and under practicing my driver. So I love that idea.
Marty, I mean, the saying we heard for years was drive for show and putt for dough. And I always said, well, if you don't drive it in play, you're putting for no dough, right? I mean, you know, you've got to at least get it in play. And I mean, obviously we've seen how important the driver is in modern golf and the way modern equipment is made. It is the most important golf club in your bag, I'd say, even over the putter for a lot of players, especially players that struggle to get it off the tee. Because I was playing golf with a friend of mine in the media a few weeks ago, and he's hitting his driver a lot better than I'd seen it a few months ago. And he goes, Shane, I realize that if I can hit it 230 off the tee and play, I can be a guest anywhere in the world. You know, I mean, if I can hit it 230 off the tee and relatively straight, I can be invited to any golf course in the world and not be embarrassed. And it's so true, right? Like that lends itself to positivity. You feel better about yourself. You're getting the ball in play. You're in the hole if you're playing a match. I mean, the driver is so much more important than I think we used to give it credit for.
Yeah.
I say this to a lot of my students. Over the last 20 years, strokes gained, the best statistical putter on the PGA Tour has been a player by the name of Denny McCarthy. And I say this, I think Denny would trade some of his putting dough for some of Rory's driving dough. Rory's got a lot of driving dough in his bank account. And that's a big reason why Rory is Rory. Not that Denny's bad. Denny's done a lovely job and he's a fantastic putter. But the old drive for show, putt for dough is not 100% true by any means.
Andrew, so far we've talked a lot about ball striking, which I think you framed very well. That's kind of the foundation of golf. But you have done a lot of tremendous work on short game technique, helping us with our wedge designs, evaluating our grinds, friction, spin generation. You know, using TrackMan is a kind of a research engine for short game. I know when you first did your wedge video, was it called The Wedge Project, Andrew?
The Wedge Project, yeah.
The Wedge Project.
Almost 10 years ago.
10 years ago, we got a lot of golf junkies, engineers around the office. I remember there right when it first came out, they all bought it, downloaded it. They're watching it at their desks and still geeking out over it. Tell us a little bit about the Wedge Project, what you kind of learned in that video, and what would you do over differently? What knowledge or insight do you have about short game technique now that if you refilm that or re-edit it, would you put in there?
Marty, firstly, the whole idea came to fruition because I wanted to understand why when we're pitching, especially when we start out pitching, we can hit that, let's call it a 50-yard shot, okay, 40 to 50-yard shot. Why is it that sometimes we hit that shot and that ball comes out nice and low and it feels great on the face and yep. It's got tons of check on it? And then on the next swing, we can strike it and it feels quite similar, but the ball seems to fly twice as high. It launches up. It seems to plummet out of the sky, hit and roll. And I wanted to better understand that. And TrackMan being what it is, was tremendously helpful in being able to gain some insights, as have a lot of your friends, the engineers at Ping, been tremendously helpful in helping me understand as to what makes it work. Why does that friction between the ball and the face work sometimes and not others? And really, ultimately, it's we get matter trapped between the face and the golf ball, be it moisture, be it grass, those green dots on the face. Whenever you hit a pitch shot or a chip shot and you look down and you see that green dot on the face, I promise you that golf ball flew higher than you intended. It had less spin than you intended. And most often, it is not your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. It's just that matter got trapped between the face and the golf ball. Yeah. And the moral of the story is this, is clean your club, play a nice fresh wedge, and a urethane-covered golf ball. Spend the little bit of extra money that you need to spend to get a quality golf ball. Keep the club clean. Play a nice fresh wedge. You're going to hit more of those low spinners. But understand, if you're playing early in the morning and it's dewy out and the ground is wet, you're going to launch the ball much higher than anticipated. It's going to spin significantly less than anticipated. That is unless you're using a hydrophobic ping wedge, which really does, once again, not a plug. It just happens to be, it makes a tremendous difference in spin rate. Anytime that coating that ping wedges have really displaces the water, and the spin rates are actually quite amazingly consistent from wet conditions to dry conditions.
Yeah. Go ahead, Shane.
Go ahead, Marty.
I think that's the big thing we're trying to solve is just that we want to provide the predictability to the golfer, right? And that low launch, high spin pitch shot is quite fun to hit. But you nailed a lot of the key ingredients, and that's where you have been super helpful of giving this push and pull to us. Hey, guys, I'm seeing this. Why does this happen? I'm seeing my golfers do this. I'm seeing this in testing. Why does it happen? That's helped push us to answer those questions, innovate on better groove designs, better finishes, and things to help you and ultimately the everyday golfer. And golf ball is a big part of that, no doubt about it. I'm glad you brought that up, and being able to pull on all those levers to create spin.
Yeah, play your best. We're both on the same train, helping exactly. Golfers play their best.
Andrew, I'm glad you mentioned the cleaning the face part of the wedge experience, because when I saw that on TrackMan one time, you know, how a wedge reacts when it's totally clean versus even a couple of shots in.
Yeah.
I mean, it is mind blowing. And I don't think golfers quite understand how much they're giving up when they don't clean their clubs every single swing. This goes back to putting the time in, right? Mm-hmm. Clean your clubs, have new grips. I mean, these are things you can do at home to help yourself out.
we did, I'll never forget, we did a fairly significant wedge test a couple of years ago, and we had players hit four shots with a wedge. I'd hand them another wedge and they'd hit another four shots, and they didn't really ever clean the club between the four shots. And at the end, this was not the objective of the test, but it just happened to be some information that we could pull out. And I said, let's take a look at spin rates from shot one, where they had a clean club, to shot four. And there was a 19% lowering of spin rate from shot one to shot four. So you hit three shots, your spin rate on average is going to be 20% less. And that's not a really dirty club face by any means. I know people who haven't cleaned their clubs in 4 months, never mind four shots.
One of my favorite little golf tools is that little retractable. I clip it on belt loop now. Oh, and when I go chip, I'm pretty diligent now. It takes a little bit of work, but you got to go in there and scrub that club face clean when you're chipping, because it's not only spin, Andrew, but you know, as we know, when the spin goes down, the launch pops straight up with it.
Yes. Yes, and we like that low launch because it's almost like throwing darts. You know, we want that more direct approach because when we get the face to grip the cover of the golf ball, the ball launches lower, it spins more, and both of those factors provide us with the ability to have more control. We can regulate where that ball lands, and we can really stop that ball that much more precisely when we've got low launch, lower launch, higher spin.
Marty, I have a question for you in dealing with kind of something you guys were chatting about a moment ago. We've talked a lot about this on the podcast as well, but I don't think I've ever asked you this question. You reach out to ambassadors at Ping for information and for, you know, I mean, feedback, right, from their players or, you know, anybody really that's in your umbrella, right? How does the engineer team reach out to the ambassadors? How does that conversation go? I mean, are you sending out new clubs to Andrew, new wedges to Andrew, and saying, let me know what you think? Like, how does the back and forth work? Because it feels like such an open dialogue at Ping amongst everybody involved. And I don't think I've ever kind of got the answer on how you might get something from Andrew, vice versa.
Yeah, great question, Shane. I think what's fun about our ambassador team is they're so diverse. So we can go to Sasha McKenzie, and he could run a academic, boxed in, highly stringent PhD level study in his biomechanics lab, right? And then we can go to Andrew. We've done this with Andrew, and we'll send him a couple different wedges with different grinds on them. He'll run a test with high handicappers or ladies, you know, lady golfers. Andrew, we've done some work on, you know, different weights, shaft weights, total weights designed. And that's more of, you know, with the real visceral performance type of hat on. So we've done some very detailed formal player tests basically that Andrew has conducted for us, right, Andrew?
Yeah.
Which has been super fun. We have Stan Utley on our team. He might be working with you know, elite or average golfers on short game, specifically short game, specifically putting. How does the golfer respond to it? So what's been fun about our team, Shane, to answer your question, is they're all so diverse. They all have unique strengths. And Andrew's been a major part of doing some fun research with us when we've reached out on wedge studies and some ladies' projects. And Andrew, I think one thing I want to talk to you about here as a follow-up to that would be kind of teaching and coaching both ladies and juniors and how that varies from, you know, your everyday high handicap male golfer.
Marty, I'm going to start with juniors. I think the... There's one young guy, 13 years old. He's quite a small guy that I teach that comes to mind. And all he wants to do is hit it longer. And he wants to get long. And he's like, oh. And every week I created this thing where we have a 6-ball speed challenge. And so we measure it. We track his ball speed from week to week when he comes out. And it's keeping him patient. And he's only growing at this speed. And I'm like, don't worry, trust me. In 3 years' time, you're going to be driving it over 300. And it's hard for him to buy into it. He wants to get good. He wants to get long now. And the big challenge I try to paint, the big picture I try to paint for my juniors is, we've got time. Let's look at the future. This is where we would like to be in 3 years, in 6 years, in 10 years. And oftentimes it's a case of, do you want to be the best 13-year-old golfer in the world or the best 23-year-old golfer in the world? Because have you ever seen a picture of those really big checks? Those big checks. You don't get
those
when
you're 13. That's right. That's right. You make a lot more money at 23.
Exactly. You'd much rather be the best 23-year-old golfer. So let's be patient. Let's stay the course. Let's keep working. We're going to work on a lot of good things over the years. We're going to have some good days and some bad days. But it's just really keeping their mindset patient and not getting too up or down based on how the last round went. For lady golfers, I teach a lot of ladies, thankfully, and oftentimes the ladies that I encounter are fairly new to the game. They haven't played a lot of golf, and they would like to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
They don't want to be overwhelmed with five wedges in their bag and the 3, 5, 7, 9 woods that oftentimes their husbands have put in their golf bag, and they want to know, okay, off the tee, this is how high I tee it, and I got to swing hard. Okay, for my second shot, this is going to be my club of choice. And I go, okay, these are the two I want you to work between. One is a 7 wood and one is a 5 hybrid. You can fall in love with either one, but I want you to fall in love with one of them. And that's oftentimes going to be your second shot club. And then from there, we're going to go, okay, 8-iron, 9-iron, wedge, and a sand wedge. You're going to pick one of those and we're going to play those next to get the ball on the green. Let's get good at that shot. Let's pitch the ball to the middle of the green and then two putts and go from there and really start to have some fun. I try to downplay the importance of scorecard, competing. Let's go out, have a good time, try to hit some shots that get up in the air and just enjoy it first, because once a junior can learn to love the game, once any beginner can learn to love the game, they'll come back to learn it later. Let's get early to the game golfers. Let's get them to love it first and get them to have a great time and hit some fun shots. My goal in every beginner lesson is I want, at the end of the lesson, we've got this ball teed up really high. They've got driver in hand and they're swinging hard. And I want them to hit a shot that makes them go, wow, that was amazing. I can't wait to do that again.
Andrew, can you tell us a little bit about Coach Camp, how it got off the ground?
Thanks for asking. Coach Camp is something my wife and I have put together. We've been doing it for coming up on 8 years now. I actually got invited to be a presenter at a fellow golf coach's event where he was doing a day, and he brought some other coaches in. And I said to him, this is fantastic. I'd love to, with your permission, have the ability to be able to recreate this just on a little bigger scale. And that's where I got the idea. And gee, it's really been so much fun over the years, Shane. We've had just about every coach, certainly in the top 20, has presented at Coach Camp. We've had some great stories, some great experiences. Ranging from Gigi flinging hats off the stage to anyone who was willing to catch one, to Joe Mayo pontificating and holding court at night, and Sean Foley presenting on Bruce Lee, and just some things that come to mind. But it's been a very fun event, but also tremendously educational. I know I've learned a tremendous amount, and the coaches that I invite are typically the ones that I would like to learn from, and I feel I've got a lot to learn, but it's getting harder and harder to find fresh new coaches. I would always – I'd love to find somebody who's a coach, but outside of the sport of golf. I think there's a tremendous amount we can learn there. In so many different ways, be it the mental side or the physical side or just the coaching of young people, so many different avenues that we can look at. But it's been a great journey so far.
Andrew, I've loved going to Coach Camp a couple times I've been, and our team's been going there. I just love everything you've done to help. And the golf coaching community all wants to help each other, right? Everyone can have their own identity, their own expertise, their own philosophies. But I just love that you've brought everyone together with Coach Camp to share those ideas. I know certainly we come away from there often with more questions unanswered than answered. And that is a beautiful thing. It kind of keeps us going on this journey to try to investigate all of the little mysteries of this game, whether it's design, coaching, fitting, performance, golf science, you name it.
And Marty, certainly thank you to you and everybody at Ping. You guys have been a big supporter of Coach Camp and certainly been a big reason why it's continued to happen each and every year. So thank you for your support. And Paul and Eric and Chris and yourself and everyone comes out and shares some amazing information. It's very cool to see actually over the last few years how Paul and Eric, Dr. Paul Wood, Dr. Eric Henriksen, who are engineers here at Ping, and how their information has really improved. And they've gotten to the point now where I know certain people who come to Coach Camp, they're not really interested in listening to the coaches. They want to listen to the PhDs and learn some new nuggets, what those guys are going to be sharing. So it's great to see.
As long as somebody's learning, right? Andrew, listen, we could talk to you for another hour and a half, I think. And we were definitely going to have you on again because I think this is just scratching the surface on all that you do for golf and all that you do for Ping. So we appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the insight. And let's schedule another pod at some point because we'd love to get you back on.
Let's do it. Thanks, gents. I appreciate the opportunity. Cheers.
That's Andrew Rice. This is the Ping Proving Grounds podcast.